This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders, reading segments from Eye of the Albatross by Carl Safina. The subtitle is Visions of Hope and Survival, published in 2002. We're going to be aboard the Masonic again, a longline fishing vessel owned and captained by Mark Lunston. I'm going to read again the description of the Masonic because it's such a landscape that we will be part of. Built nearly 70 years ago, the wooden 70-foot Masonic was the last of a breed of sail-powered halibut schooners, hybrids between old-style Gloucester cod schooners and Norwegian workboats. Mark has owned the Masonic for about 15 years. He knows who all of the previous owners are. Mark says this boat is made of original wood, old growth. It would be impossible to make this boat today because fully 95% of North America's ancient forests have been cut down. Nowadays, the Masonic's sail masts remain, but rather than sails, she is propelled by a 365-horsepower six-cylinder diesel. She carries 4,500 gallons of fuel, enough for 20 days of cruising. On the Masonic's foredeck lie coil after coil after coil of ropes with buoys and anchors for securing the ends of the long lines to the bottom. Elsewhere on the boat, coil after coil after coil of fishing lines and thousands and thousands and thousands of hooks. The wheelhouse sits up high amidships. It contains the skipper's private bunk as well as all the navigating electronics, radars, sonars, GPSs, and radios and maps. The boat's aft deck is a large baiting station that can be closed against the weather. The stern rail accommodates a chute for sending the baited lines overboard. The galley occupies the bow of the boat below decks. To get to the galley, you step down an almost vertical set of steps that is more ladder than stairs. It contains a diesel-burning stove and oven for cooking and heat, a sink, and a table shaped to fit the wedge-shaped bow. Surrounding the table are hidden storage space and five tiny bunks, barely wider than a man's shoulders, tucked into the bow of the boat. Each bunk has a bare bulb and a cramped storage rack. The galley is thus kitchen, dining room, living room, bedroom, and because it has a television with a video player, an entertainment center. And now on to more of the story of this trip the Masonic is taking, going after sablefish off huge Kodiak Island. Recounting of Sean's near-death experience on the wrong side of the element interface continues throughout the long day. By sundown, Mark has already received an email reply from Sean's stepfather admonishing Sean that when a man named Spence fell off the Republic, he at least got the fish he was after. That chide, notwithstanding, these guys, at least Masonic's crew, are not the macho types I was expecting for such laborious and hazardous fishing. They are inured to hard work without being hardened by it, and they do less swaggering than some sports fishermen I know. Perhaps that's because just being part of the crew proves plenty. Nobody has to fake anything. The work is difficult and dangerous enough to weed out the strutters. Mark's comment, there's no room for prima donnas. This requires teamwork. Cal announces lunch, baked halibut. Although Mark had jokingly told me that fishermen's four food groups are alcohol, cholesterol, caffeine, and nicotine, the food on board is hearty and nutritious. Cal pulls his weight on deck and still effortlessly puts together big, delicious meals. Mac wolfs several huge platefuls of rice and then asks Cal whether there'll be any rice at supper. The meal seems altogether too rushed for so fine a feast, but Mark has a different perspective. He says, during the Derby days, instead of having 20 minutes to actually stop and sit down to a nice hot lunch like this, the cook would make 3 dozen peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and put them out on the hatch. People would just reach for sandwiches as they got hungry. They're almost always hungry. Watch these guys work for a few hours, and the importance of food becomes obvious. Here on deck, they drink lots of fruit juice and water and snack on candy bars and chocolate. They need all the hydration and calories they can get their jaws around. They work harder than anyone I've ever seen. The effort promises big rewards and big hazards. Fishing in Alaska is one of the most dangerous professions anywhere. It's a pain for gain, high risk for high return venture. Jim comments that his most memorable fishing trip was his first time out for sablefish. We caught 90,000 pounds in 6 days, and I was in extreme pain the whole time. Mark's most memorable trip was his first to the Aleutians and the Bering Sea. It was the first week in April. About 5 days into the trip, he says, we hit a horrendous storm. A wave broke over the entire boat. It blew out all the wheelhouse windows. Because I had no experience, it wasn't all that frightening. I just kind of thought, I guess this is what we do. I figured, the captain knows what he's doing. He grins. It didn't seem as terrifying then as it would now. I didn't realize at the time what I know as an experienced skipper, that the captain was scared witless. Mark's had other close calls and seen boats with decks swamped in gales, but he says, the most memorable trips are the good trips when we absolutely kill 'em, like the time we loaded the boat in 2 days. Tim nods his assent. His most memorable trip was the first time he got a full crew share. The satisfaction. Mac remembers a 4-day halibut trip during Derby days. Over the entire 4 days, he slept for 2 hours. I got really close to hallucinating. At one point, I was supposed to cut up a salmon for dinner, and I had the meat cleaver in my hand, and I realized I couldn't see my hand, and I thought, this is dumb. So I put the cleaver down, and I picked up a smaller knife and went at it much more carefully. But that was kind of the defining moment in my career, because I realized that with the right attitude, you can do anything within reason, and I wouldn't want to do it again. Mac's most memorable trip was the time every other boat went in, because the wind was blowing a steady 60 miles an hour, and for a week they fished in 20-foot seas while the rest of the fleet was sheltering in port. We were a pretty wild crew. These were my friends, and we all fit in each other's energy. But I wouldn't want to do it now. No way. It was hard, and it was dangerous. But at the time, it was just one of those things, you know? I wryly say it sounds like character building. He says, we were all characters to begin with. Now I'm boring, boring, boring. Cal remembers his first trip on the Masonic as a very positive experience with guys that were competent and did their job well. Mark adds, that was a cool trip, wasn't it? To me, he fills in, we fished right next to the ice pack. Sean Bailey recounts the terror of a January storm, when 100-mile-an-hour winds built deadly breaking waves 40 feet tall. His stepfather, Carl Vito, was behind the wheel of the Masonic. Mark was not on that trip. Carl had just woken everybody up to tie stuff down. He had been behind the wheel for 10 hours trying to get us behind some island out of the wind. I offered to go down and make us some grub. There was water sloshing in the galley. The deck mats had got jammed in the scuppers and plugged them shut, preventing the deck from draining. But I brought up a sandwich anyway, and before he could even get a bite, he says, hold on, hold on, and he took the boat out of gear. We took a big wave. It rolled us way over. As we were still coming back up, another one smashes right on top of us. Bam! It put us all the way over on our side. The pilot house struck the sea surface, and the windows blew out, and water was streaming in, and alarms started going off everywhere. That was the scaredest I'd ever been. He shakes his head at the flashback and continues, after what seemed like forever, but was probably only a few seconds, the boat rolled slowly upright again. All you can do in conditions like that is to try to keep the bow pointed into the sea. So Carl kept holding the boat into it for hours until the storm broke. Sean adds, it was lucky there was no shoreline behind us. He'd been trying for 24 hours to keep us jogging forward, but the wind and waves had driven us backward 17 miles. So yeah, it was pretty scary. Our radar had gotten blown out. So then we were coming in at Dutch Harbor without radar. That place is tricky at night. So Carl had us all up on the bow, being lookouts. Human radar, he laughs. Like the old days. Tim asks, what year was that? Sean replies, that was the last Derby year. That last Derby year, people drowned rather than miss a day of fishing. Those that lived made half the money they earn now. At 10:30 p.m., it's not yet fully dark, but the crew quits anyway because these aren't the Derby days, Cal says to me. During the Derby years, there was a lot more hurry and less sleep. We called it turn and burn. The operation is very casual now. 18-hour days of manual labor that start before dawn isn't most people's idea of casual, but all is relative. We take off our slimy deck outerwear and crowd our scented selves into the galley. After several days, I and my clothing are packing a suite of odors that can be masked only by a deckload of cut herring and squid and a putrid peer group. Fortunately, that is no problem. Mark says he'll take a shower when he gets back to port, whether he needs one or not. Tim, in an insightful historical retrospective, informs him that the Roman Empire fell because of warm baths, adding that showers are for sissies. As the days wear on, a growing collection of filthy, damp, smelly clothing hangs from lines strung among the bunks. Gloves hang on clothespins near the stove. The galley itself is frequently a comedy of gravity. Falling dishes, falling juice bottles. Cal sweeps from the floor a bowl of fallen potatoes we've cut up and washes them in the sink. Clambering around the crowded cabin and getting seated at the cramped table for dinner gets increasingly difficult. But tonight it is so worth the extra effort because Cal has utterly outdone himself with an extraordinary supper of lamb and sable fish, complete with mint jelly and gourmet bottled sparkling spring water. Just in time to really enjoy it, my digestive system is functioning again. Cal usually cooks to perfection on the rocking diesel stove, but this sable fish is something to go lyrical about. No wonder the Japanese buy every single one this fleet catches. These are the most buttery-fleshed fish I've ever tasted. Most Americans have no idea sable fish even exist. The fish are bought at princely sums for export as soon as they hit the dock, sometimes sooner. Mark explains, in Japan, it's one of those presentation fishes. It's made to look beautiful, and people pay for it. After dinner, because these are not the Derby days, we have Leisure Entertainment, a National Geographic video, Search for the Giant Squid. As the video starts, Jim remarks, they're good eating. Morning comes bright and finally sunny. The crew says sunny weather means bad weather is coming. Well, of course, bad weather means bad weather is already here, and sunny weather means bad weather will come. In the Gulf of Alaska, nothing means good weather is coming. Winds are scheduled to increase with a cold front. Ominously, the Coast Guard is on the radio trying to raise a boat whose EPIRB signal they are receiving. EPIRB stands for Emergency Position Indicating Radio Beacon. It's a unit that slides into a holder, usually on the wheelhouse. If it starts floating, it begins transmitting a satellite signal to the Coast Guard with its position. Usually, the only way an EPIRB starts floating is if the boat is no longer floating. As the wind increases, seas build and the air cools. The crew maintains their pace, their attitude, and their banter. As the day ages, the weather maintains its threatening posture. All day the surface of the sea has been whipped into a tight, white-capped chop by a steady 25-mile-per-hour wind, a grim and grizzled sea, ragged and disheveled as an unmade bed. By mid-afternoon, the weather facts arrive showing a strong air pressure gradient. A stiff blow is on its way. Mark pensively weighs his options. Stay and try to fish through it, or suspend fishing during the blow and try to endure it, or run ahead of it and wait it out in port. The forecast predicts a gale. Options 1 and 2 carry the risk of getting trapped. If the storm gets out of hand, it may be impossible to run to shelter. We are only 8 hours from the nearest port. Quote, even if we can fish through it, people get battered and worn out. More things sliding across the decks, more strain on the fishing gear, risk of accident increases. You tend to lose a day for every day of fishing like that. He decides that unless the 4 p.m. forecast changes, we'll fish hard today and then haul aboard all the gear that is out and run for port at about 2 in the morning. By late afternoon, the fishing improves markedly. To be more accurate, the catching improves markedly. The fishing itself is getting harder with building winds and waves, but we're getting more and larger fish and much cleaner catch of sablefish with fewer dead grenadiers to discard. After working 12 hours, everyone wants to stay on the grounds and keep fishing. We've been resetting after each haul. Right now, the seas are white-capped and building, but not huge. All the gear is in the water, fishing, when Mark goes to the wheelhouse to get the updated forecast. Mark receives word over the radio that the EPIRB, whose distress signal the Coast Guard was receiving, had gone off by accident. But such a false alarm keeps everyone on edge. Mark listens with concern to the updated forecast. A mechanically generated voice of the government sends its matter-of-fact prognostications, gale warnings, southwest winds increasing to 50 knots, seas building to 20 feet. Mark shakes his head and says he hates heavy weather. You never get used to it, and the older you get, the more you hate it. The mountains of water, the murderous wind, the driving streaks of foam. Cal, who has come in to deliver a sandwich to Mark, adds, it becomes another world. He lists the only two advantages of heavy weather, and they are, you get to wear all your rain gear, and if the boat sinks, you don't have to clean it. He adds, fishing has been likened to a prison sentence with the possibility of drowning. Of course, many things carry risk. Driving a car is risky, but compare. Cars crash in a blink. Boats in storms sink after hours of desperate effort and terror, like a wild animal in the cage of your ribs. Mark, looking a bit weary, clicks off the radio and says with finality, we're going in. He sticks his head out of the wheelhouse and announces that we'll run for port after hauling all the gear. Then he sends an email to a fish buyer on Kodiak saying we should be at their dock in the early afternoon tomorrow. Now we will pick up everything. This means that the work day that began at 4 a.m. will stretch to 2 a.m. tonight. No one grumbles. It's just direction, and everyone takes it matter-of-factly. Faced with a 22-hour workday in worsening conditions, Tim's only comment is, hell, we've done it many times before. It's no big deal. During Mark's turn at the rollers, gaffing, swinging, he occasionally pulls off an unused piece of bait, tossing it to the waiting birds. A fulmar comes hovering so close in the stiff wind, hanging in midair, that Mark pushes it away with the gaff. Watching the fulmars pace the pilot house as we move to the next string, I'm impressed anew by the shaping forces of hunger and harshness, and by how much the harshness that challenges life is what causes the beauty. Birds fly because they must escape predators and search for food. Trees grow skyward because they compete fiercely with other trees for light. Living things need something to push off of. Each of us needs challenges to give us the right shape. The heavenly weightlessness of space weakens the bones of astronauts, a demonstration of the principle that we need grounding to support ourselves, that to achieve and maintain strength, we need to conquer forces that tend to hold us down. The weightless, painless paradise that we conjure is heaven, where all is given, no thing is contested, nothing carries danger or threatens loss, and no effort can bring gain or cause change, could never create the beauty of a bird, the sleek speed of a dolphin, the love of a child, the compassion, intellect, and inventiveness of the human spirit. We could not exist in paradise. Our minds would unravel, and we would wither and dull to nothing and expire. Blessed are our enemies and challengers. Here is the great paradox of the flesh, Without the things that can kill us, we could not survive. Without challenges to our very existence, we could never have come to be. Sablefish, sleek and supple, continue coming aboard, as did the first ones so many thousands of hooks ago. The second-to-last string was the best yet, and the fish are big. The crew and Mark are disappointed that the weather is preventing them from getting the gear again on this spot. Running the boat toward the last string of hooks, Mark in the wheelhouse is listening to Bach's Toccata and Fugue in D minor, as increasing winds orchestrate the shape of the world outside. The hours slip away. The day slides by. The evening grays with age, then dims and fades. But the work persists. A little before sunset, around 10 p.m., we begin hauling the last string. The reel becomes surreal as the labor proceeds. The fishermen eat more than their share of ibuprofen pills, ignoring their body's warnings that they are exceeding their physical limits. I'm sure I couldn't hack this work. I just wouldn't have what it takes to labor this hard under these conditions. Most people would jump at the chance to make $100,000 in 4 months. Most people would be spit out after the first day or broken after the first week. This is something like climbing Mount Everest. You're drawn by the romance and ambition and the dream. But when you get there, you realize that it is all about enduring pain and isolation. Cal, not yet 24 years old, says, "It's hard to believe we used to work like this all the time." Sean says, "Work 20, sleep 4. Work 20. Geez, I don't know how I did it." Cal laughs, "Ha! We're getting to be old men already." Elder statesman of the deck crew, Tim says to me, "This kind of work is very hard when you're young, but as you get older, it's also very hard." He adds, "There is less wasted motion as you get older, though. The work takes other things out of you." Tim talks to me about being away from loved ones for months, missing birthdays and holidays. Not everybody can bear that. His brother, in the Russian crab fishery for the last 8 years, barely got home in time to see his child born. The crew is a perpetual motion machine. The work grinds on for hours with a kind of industrial monotony. Except that this is not the inside of a factory. We're in the Gulf of Alaska doing something authentic and suffused with splendor and power. And we're in some danger because anything real entails real risks. What is it that seems romantic about this kind of difficult, dangerous, repetitive work? Is there a purity that attracts us? If you're not inured to all the killing, it can get to you. And even if you are inured, the work can kill you. This is not so much pure as genuine. This work is what it appears to be. Not long ago, everything was real. Now the real seems too hard, because the fake has come to substitute for real experiences, and so we orbit the genuine because we recognize the value of authenticity, which we call the romantic, but we experience it only vicariously because we are unwilling to shoulder the risk and the effort required to really be in it. The wind's whistling in the riggings intensifies and the boat is rolling more heavily. Mark has been on this boat in breaking 30-foot seas. He says the birds scarcely notice such weather. The birds will just be sitting on the water, paddling into the oncoming seas. When a big breaking comer threatens to smash them, they simply lift off over the white water and plunk down again in the next trough. At midnight, Cal and I emerge onto the Masonic's heaving deck. Now the middle of the boat is almost constantly awash with waves rushing in through the scuppers, sliding across the boards and back out into the other side of night. A dark wind is howling. It's unnerving. Under the deck lights, we're carrying hot burritos, sandwiches, just-baked apple pie with ice cream, insulated containers of hot coffee and tea, and candy bars. Everyone else chows heartily. The rolling seas and a touch of foreboding dread are dampening my appetite. Except for Cal, who has been below to cook, Mac, who came in to put on a dry shirt, is the only crew member who has been off the deck in the last 22 hours. No one has had anything that could be called a break. At almost 2 a.m, the last hook clicks through the rollers. The seas have built to a dark and formidable presence, and I realize it's the fish who have caught all of us. The gulls and fulmars have remained alongside, illuminated by the boat's halo, yakkering at us, but the albatrosses have receded into the wailing, tilted night. Mark consults his tide and current book and considers the wind and wave conditions that will probably accompany our run in. He has two choices, running west of Tugadak Island, which entails slowly quartering into the wind and seas, or running with seas astern, a smoother ride around Sitkanak Island and into the Sitkanak Strait. But if the predicted gale comes up early, the strait will get very nasty. If the bigger blow holds off, the latter route is shorter and more comfortable. Both routes lead to Alatak Bay, near the remote southern extremity of Kodiak Island. Mark eventually decides on the longer, less comfortable route that is safer in case of worst weather. The run is about 30 miles to the islands and another 30 miles into Alatak. But in these weather conditions, the boat goes slowly. We will make only around 7 knots, a veritable crawl. Mark and the crew will take two-hour turns at the wheelhouse. They draw cards. Mac gets the first shift. He's been working for almost 22 hours, but says he's glad to get the first turn because afterward he can sleep straight through. Climbing into his bunk, Sean pronounces, "Oh, my bunk is my friend. Yes, my bunk is my friend. A time for work, a time to dream." The bow raises a white noise hiss as it cleaves the heaving seas. During hours in the rack, I feel the sea change when we alter course from pounding into quartering sea on our port bow to having the sea following us on our port stern. I finally sleep well for a while. I will stop there. I hope you're enjoying being at sea with Carl Safina. I'm reading segments from the great book, Eye of the Albatross, Visions of Hope and Survival. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. You can find all of my programs archived at WDRT.org under the podcast archives. Thank you, WDRT, and thank you for listening. And do you know what that Bach Toccata and Fugue in D minor was that Captain Lunston was playing in the wheelhouse during the fierce storm?